From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Listen, we have got a great show for you today. We have author Mary Roach. She'll be here to talk about her latest book. It's about space travel. But first, you know, a really wonderful thing happened this week. A typical American family in Virginia, the Nicholas Armstrongs, got a visit from a financial advisor, one by the name of Barack Obama. It's true. He was there. He visited their home to learn their concerns about the economy. But it turns out the president learned a lot from the humble citizens and their folksy ways. In fact, he went back to the White House with a plan to eliminate the deficit, a Rahm Emanuel swear jar. Share your good ideas with us. Give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Elaine in Salinas, California.
Hey, Salinas is nice, John Steinbeck country. How are things there?
It's a beautiful day. We're having a great day.
I'm glad to hear it. And what do you do there?
I'm the director of education for a vocational college.
Oh, a vocational college, a school where people learn trades.
Yes.
What are the most relevant trades to be learning right now if you're a young person? I would think one of them is to be unemployed would be something.
Well, we don't teach them that.
Okay.
We find that allied health is the most popular, lots of people being medical assistants and pharmacy techs and things like that.
Right. Exactly.
So to medicate all the people who don't have jobs.
Right.
Exactly.
Largely.
Elaine, let me introduce you to the panel this week. First up, say hello to the man behind the world-famous podcast, Too Beautiful to Live, Mr. Luke Burbank.
Hi, Luke.
Hey, Elaine.
Next, a comedian, director, and author of the new book, Satiristas, Mr. Paul Provenza.
Hello, Elaine.
Hi, Paul.
And a comedian whose first CD, I Heart Jokes, is out now. She's performing at the Pachoke Theater on October 1st in Long Island. Ms. Paula Poundstone, right there.
Hey, Elaine.
Welcome to the show, Elaine. You're going to start us off, of course, with Who's Carl This Time. Carl Castle is going to read you three quotes from the week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain just two of them. Do that, you'll win our prize, Carl Castle's voice on your home answering machine. You ready to go?
Yes, I am.
All right. Here is your first quote.
She is not a viable candidate for any office in this state. She could not be elected dog catcher.
That was a Republican Party chairman talking about Christine O'Donnell. She upset the GOP favorite in the primary for the Senate seat where?
Delaware?
Yes, indeed, in Delaware. The Tea Party wanted the GOP to go more to the right, and they oversteered. It's the political equivalent of a hungry senior citizen trying to park at the Denny's and just going straight through the window. So the new GOP nominee for the Senate in Delaware, Ms. O'Donnell, has spent the last decade or so running for office and going on various TV shows to express a variety of opinions, primarily her opposition to most kinds of sex, extramarital, premarital, homosexual, and the kind of sex you have with yourself. She's against that. She says now this is all irrelevant. She wants to be judged on her positions. Her position is standing straight up, fully dressed, her hands at her sides, wearing oven mitts. How is she going to fit in with like the old boy culture of the Senate? You know, we imagine her walking up to Senator David Vitter, for example, and saying, I want to talk to you about chastity. And Vitter says, oh, I love chastity, but she's too expensive. By the way, I want to say this about Christine O'Donnell. Not all of her professed opinions are about sex. She also does not believe in evolution.
Without sex, really, there can be no evolution.
Exactly. So. And she also, she said this a few years ago, she fears scientists have already cloned mice with, quote, fully functioning human brains.
They came in third in the polls.
There you are. Carl, what is Elaine's next quote?
Corn sugar? Yeah, because when we think of health food, we think sugar.
That was Gawker.com. It was commenting on a name change this week. A name change to what much maligned food ingredient?
corn syrup.
Yes, high fructose corn syrup. Very well done.
Thank you.
Very good, yes. For years now, high fructose corn syrup has been the snidely whiplash of food additives. Foods proudly advertise no high fructose corn syrup, even though they're loaded with other things that are just as bad for you, like cane sugar and strychnine and bits of broken glass. Well, Big Corn is tired of it, so from now on you'll be bringing on your early onset diabetes with a much more homey sounding corn sugar. It's a lot better. Whereas corn syrup made you morbidly obese, corn sugar makes you morbidly jolly.
I don't care what they call it. I'm going to find it and drink it.
Yeah. You like it straight?
Isn't that what, like, caro syrup? Isn't that what that is?
Oh, you sort of. Caro syrup is corn syrup, but this is a different kind that's used
for food.
Oh,
it's a different kind, because yeah. I do like corn syrup, yeah.
Oh, sure. Oh, by the way, in other news on the naming front, MSG is now called Happy Flavor Sprinkles. The preservative BHT is now called Eternal Youth. And napalm is now called Action Tan. Elaine, here is your last quote.
We're going to Australia!
That was somebody launching her final season of her daily talk show with a big surprise for her audience. Who was it?
Oprah.
Yes, Oprah Winfrey. Yay. Oprah promised that her premiere would feature, quote, the biggest surprise in Oprah show history, and she did not disappoint her fans, mainly because her fans are physically incapable of being disappointed in her. If she robbed them at gunpoint, they'd say, isn't it wonderful she's helping my wallet lose weight? Anyway, Oprah announced she was taking the whole studio audience to Australia on a plane piloted by John Travolta. Actual pilot. You can tell a plane is piloted by Travolta because it's got a bumper sticker saying, L. Ron Hubbard is my co-pilot.
They're having the way that people are, they're doing a show taping in Australia, I believe in Sydney, and it's like 3,000 seats, and they've already started, I'm not kidding, this national lottery to be one of the 3,000 people who gets to see Oprah live in Australia.
Wow.
Which to me seems like, isn't the image of Australians tarnished enough?
Really? Okay. What is wrong with Oprah?
I think of Australians as being a little bit, you know, with the whole, like, penal colony past way behind them. I think of them as being kind of like...
There will be no more penal when Christine...
Hold on.
Certainly not colonies of it.
They just seem, I don't know, I assume people in other parts of the world are a little more evolved than us. They have sort of more refined taste in some way. Then I find out, oh, no, they're also lining up
to see Oprah.
To go see Oprah.
Anyway, Carl, how did Elaine do in our quiz?
Well, you can't do better, Peter. She had 3 correct answers, so Elaine, you win our prize.
You did well, Elaine. That was great.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Right now, panel, of course, it's time for you to answer some questions about the week's news. Luke, Anthony Schaffer's new war memoir, Operation Dark Heart, promises to be a damning expose of U.S. operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Well, the Pentagon is upset about all this information. It's about to come out, and they've decided to do what?
They're going to crash the Amazon Kindle website
so
no. that people cannot read it on the subway as they're going to work.
No.
They are going to...
Much more basic than that, old school.
They're going to disappear him. They're going to take him.
That's pretty old school.
They're going to take him to Guantanamo.
It's actually pretty new school, isn't it?
Turns out they're going to take advantage of the fact that Amazon gives you free shipping over 10,000 copies.
Oh, they're going to try to buy up all the copies?
They're going to buy all of them, every single copy. The book alleges that the U.S. military had the chance to defeat the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, but they screwed it up. The Pentagon, rather than allow the book to hit shelves, is negotiating with St. Martin's Press to buy the entire 10,000-copy first print run in order, they say, to protect classified information. Of course, that means that Operation Dark Heart will be an instant, if inexplicable, bestseller. This will be the first time it's happened since a former operative named Dan Brown revealed troop movements in a book called The Da Vinci Code.
That's got to be the best and worst news you can get as an author.
Yeah. It's good, like, news.
You sold out.
Bad news.
No one can read it.
Yeah. Would you take that deal?
If St. Martin's is smart,
yeah,
they'll just keep printing that bad
news. Oh, what do you know? 10,000 more.
Well, I know my new book, Operation Dark Heart 2, is already scheduled to do very well.
Well, as you can imagine, you know, not only are all these authors coming out trying to reveal classified secrets so they get the same deal, but the publishing houses are going to their backlists, all the classic books, and they're updating them with classified information so that the Pentagon will buy those too. So, for example, you're going to see Where the Wild Things and Our Troops Are. Eat, Pray, Love, Reveal Nuclear Codes. And The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and a Tattoo of Covert Operatives' Names. Right now it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game in the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Lilia from D.C.
Hey, Lilia from D.C. How are things there?
They're very good.
That's great. What do you do there in our nation's capital?
Oh, I'm almost afraid to tell you guys, but I'm a lawyer.
Oh, no! What kind of law do you do?
I do product liability defense.
So if I choke on this soda lid, you would help me or help the soda company?
I'd defend Coca-Cola.
Oh!
Lily.
Yes.
Nice to have you with us. We are going to play with you the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Lilia's topic?
I know what you did last summer.
Summer's ended. Maybe it wasn't everything you hoped it would be. You didn't get that even tan. You never learned to surf. And that pretty exchange student, Sandy, never made out with you on the beach. Our panelists are going to tell you three stories about summer getaways that turned out to be bummers. Only one of them actually happened. To choose the true story, and you'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine.
Fantastic.
Ready to play? Let's hear first from Luke Burbank.
All Maya George wanted this summer was a little rest and relaxation. So the 28-year-old and her friends did what many Serbian folks do. They headed for the beach. George figured she'd catch some rays, read a book, maybe take a dip. Here's what happened. George was frolicking off the coast of Montenegro when a diver confused her for something else, something more, how do you say, Free Willy-ish, and tried to harpoon her. She was treated for her injuries, but when she emerged from the hospital, she saw this headline in the Croatian Times: Roly-poly holidaymaker swears she'll go on a diet. On the upside, George says she did catch up on her sleep, just in a morphine-induced hazy sort of way, and she made friends with her fellow hospital patients. Real friends. The kind who would yell, "Hey, look out, that guy's about to harpoon you with a spear gun."
A woman mistaken for a whale on the beach in Montenegro and suffering the indignities thereafter. Your next story of a summer vacation gone wrong comes from Paula Poundstone.
Let me just say, Lilia, that if you are in any way injured during the reading of the story... On Labor Day weekend, 42-year-old Cameron Barrett left his wife and twin 7-year-old boys awash in back-to-school fever in Chippewa, Connecticut, while he slipped away to borrow a friend's Ocala, Florida lakefront townhouse to squeeze the last bit of kickback time out of the summer. It was a kind of working vacation, really, says Barrett. I had some meetings on Friday, but I had big plans for fishing and paintball after that. His vacation plans were not realized, however, when, after checking out the glorious Ocala Lake at around 8 a.m., he left the front door open and began looking through cabinets to find something to eat. I heard a noise. It was like schla, schla kind of a noise. But it wasn't until I heard the chair scooch on the kitchen floor that I turned to look. And when he turned to look, he saw not one, not two, but three large crocodiles coming towards him. These things can move. I jumped up on the kitchen table and they literally surrounded me. I felt like Captain Hook. My cell phone was in my pants pocket and I didn't have them on yet. Mr. Barrett spent the next 48 hours on the kitchen table. He was finally discovered by a neighbor who noticed the door had been open for 2 days. The worst part was that I had left the TV on C-SPAN.
A man expecting a wonderful vacation by a lake in Florida spends 48 hours hiding from crocodiles in his kitchen. Your last story of a summer holiday gone horribly wrong comes from Paul Provenza.
Larry Adeo and his new wife, Karen, chose to spend their honeymoon on a relaxing Caribbean cruise. First port of call, St. Croix. While Karen decided to go duty-free shopping, Larry decided to relax from his post-wedding stress trauma on a white sandy beach to meet Karen back on the ship in 3 hours. He awoke to see the cruise ship off in the distance. Frantic, he hired a local fisherman to speed him out to the ship. A mere half mile away from the ship, the fishing boat's engine stalled. The fisherman radioed for help. An emergency rescue boat was sent to pick the two stranded seafarers up and bring them back to shore. Larry then chartered a sightseeing helicopter to chopper him out to the cruise ship halfway to its next port of call. The helicopter caught up with the ship and lowered him safely on board. Overjoyed, he ran down to cabin 313, burst open the door, only to discover Milt and Ethel Golding taking their afternoon nap. That's when he realized he was on the wrong ship. It turns out his ship and his wife were still back at port waiting for him.
All right, here are your choices. From Luke Burbank, a woman gets mistaken for a whale in Montenegro. From Paula Poundstone, a man ends up spending his Florida vacation hiding from crocodiles. Or from Paul Provenza, a guy misses the boat, quite literally, on his honeymoon cruise. Which of these is the real story of a vacation gone wrong?
I'm going to go with number two, the crocodile.
You're going to go for the guy who spent 2 days, 48 hours, standing at a kitchen table, surrounded by crocodiles, forced to watch C-SPAN.
Yes.
That does sound awful. Your choice then was Paul as well. We actually spoke to the person who endured this. Here it is.
I was near the shore, 10 meters at least, and I started swimming and I felt a hit, just like harpooned.
That was Maya George talking about getting harpooned in Montenegro this summer. Sadly, you did not earn our prize because, as you now know, Luke had the real story. You did, however, earn a point for Paula for her very realistic, horrifying story. Thank you so much for playing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye,
Lily. Thanks, Lilia.
C-A-C-A-T-I-O-N. In the summer sun. Put away the books. We're out of school. The weather's warm, but we'll play it cool. We're on vacation. Having lots of fun.
And now the game where we talk to very informed people about something on which they've got no clue. It's called Not My Job. Mary Roach is a science writer who likes to tackle the big and often uncomfortable topics, death in her book Stiff, and sex in her book Bonk. Her latest is about preparing human beings to travel in space, and weirdly, it has three words in the title. It's called Packing for Mars. Mary Roach, welcome to Wait, Wait.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Great to have you. So let's talk about your choice of topics, because you like writing about uncomfortable things. Your first book, Stiff, which is hilarious and great, is about what happens to dead bodies after you're done with them and you looked at cadavers and so on and so forth. And then in the book Bonk, you looked at the scientific study of sex, which involved people in uncomfortable positions, quite literally. What draws you to these topics?
I have the mind of a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell.
Mary, having read your books, I could take that to mean that you actually have one sitting on your shelf, because I know you can get around.
No, that's just the head, Peter.
No, sorry, excuse me. That was removed. But no, and of course, in your latest book, I should not neglect Packing for Mars, which is about humans in space, you spend an awful lot of time talking about, shall we say, the elimination function.
That's the 12-year-old boy angle, but it's a fascinating topic, is it not?
Oh, I can't get enough of it myself. So how do you pick your topics?
Well, it's got to have a little science, it's got to have a little history, a little humor, and something gross. So
right.
That pretty much leaves sex, dead bodies, and poop.
There you are.
So after this, my career is done.
Right. What was really interesting to me about this book is because it made me, as your books always do, is it made me think about something that I had not thought about before, which was exactly how much planning and preparation has to go into sending people into space. And to me, among the most interesting parts of the book is the testing of the psychological experience of being in space.
Yeah, I mean, the talking about 5-6 people in a little tiny room for weeks, months, years at a time. I mean, can you imagine anything worse?
That doesn't sound unlike parts of tonight's show.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you write about is sort of the space travel version of cabin fever. Well, people locked in the small space together for weeks at a time can get very, very hostile towards each other.
Yeah, they get very hostile, but here's the thing. They can't take it out on each other because they, you know, that makes the situation worse. They depend on each other for survival, so they turn it inward, and then they get sort of depressed. And I interviewed this cosmonaut, Alexander Levake, and I said, he was up on Mir for 6 months. I said, did you get really depressed? And he said, Mary, there were times when I wanted to hang myself, but of course, it's zero gravity. And you can't.
Why don't they do this program like Survivor where they get to vote somebody out of the capsule?
I think that would be a great idea. For a Mars mission, I think they should do a reality show.
I want to ask you about two things. First of all, sex in space. You say there has been none and there will be none. They've decided not to allow couples in space.
They don't allow married couples in space. NASA does not know. That's true.
If you wanted to send studies. Some people up that weren't going to have sex, though, wouldn't a married couple be the perfect candidates?
The other thing you write about at some length in your book is the extraordinary science and preparation and technology that goes into using the restroom in space, because it turns out that we, as you point out, are evolved to do that sort of thing here on Earth with gravity.
Yes, gravity is your friend, because gravity gives you good separation.
Between you and what you're trying to rid yourself of.
This is the holy grail of the NASA waste management team, good separation. Because without gravity, I'm going to use a NASA euphemism for you, contributions. Okay? The contribution to the toilet, it just kind of hovers. It doesn't fall. You don't have the prop. So you need to encourage egesta, another favorite euphemism. You need to encourage the material, the egesta, the contributions, to go down into the toilet some other way, so they use airflow. It's basically you are sitting on a shop vac.
I don't know why we don't bring some of that technology right back here to the good old USA.
Tang worked out so well. Yeah. Why not shop vac toilets?
Velcro was very big. This could catch on.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
But then they need to test the toilet, too. That's when it gets really scary.
They test the toilet?
Okay, they have to make sure it works in zero gravity. That means you have to haul the whole thing over to Ellington Field and load it onto one of those zero gravity planes that goes up and down. And you have 22 seconds of zero gravity to test it.
I couldn't perform under that pressure. No way. No way.
I talked to a guy who was on that flight. And he says that there was a curtain between him and the toilet. He said, when we go over the top, you'd see the toilet rise up off the bottom of the plane, and you'd hear these guys going, go, 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 go!
That sounds like the best fraternity hazing of all time.
Mary Roach, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
It's-a-me, Mario.
As I'm sure you've noticed by the national celebrations, parades, and solemn ceremonies, this week was the 25th anniversary of the release of Super Mario Brothers, the greatest and most long-lasting video game franchise of all time. So, Mary, answer two questions correctly about Mario and his friends. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on your home answering machine. Carl, who is author Mary Roach playing for?
It's a Phil Esterda of a Poughkeepsie, New York.
Do I need to reset you, Carl? Are you ready to play, Mary?
I think so.
All right. Here's your first question. Mario was known in Japan as Jumpman, but he became Mario first in the United States and then the rest of the world because, well, why? A, the discussion about what to name him was interrupted by the landlord looking for the rent. The landlord named Mario.
B, one of the designers based the character on his favorite nun back in parochial school, Sister Maria. Or C, one of the designers had an uncle named Mario he hated, so he wanted to drop barrels on him.
I'm going with barrels.
You're going to go with barrels. He just hated his Uncle Mario so much he wanted to drop little pixelated barrels on him. No, I'm afraid it was actually A, it was the landlord. This happened in Seattle. The Nintendo USA, the designers are trying to come up with a name for the American version, and the landlord, Mario Segale, comes in and says, "Where's my rent?" And they said, "Aha, Mario." There you go. All right, two more chances. Mario faces a lot of enemies in his various games, including the Boo enemies that first appeared in Super Mario 64. These are quiet little ghosts that will suddenly attack you when you get close. They were inspired by what? A, the game designer's dog, B, the game designer's wife, or C, the game designer's own legendary temper?
I'm going to go with the... the wife.
Yes, the wife. Very good. We quote from an account of the invention of the game. His wife is very quiet normally, but one day she exploded, maddened by all the time he spent at work. In the game, there is now a character who shrinks when Mario looks at it, but when Mario turns away, it will grow large and menacing. All right, this is great, Mary. You have one more chance to get it right. Here we go and win the game. Believe it or not, but back in 1993, there was a live-action movie made of the Super Mario Brothers game. It was called Super Mario Brothers. In his autobiography, star John Leguizamo says that he and co-star Bob Hoskins made it through the difficult and demanding production by doing what? A, constantly playing the game on set. B, making up elaborate backstories to explain how Mario and Luigi became plumbers. Or C, drinking heavily.
Yeah, well, the first one's too boring.
Absolutely.
I'm going to go with the backstories.
They sat around and they said, so how did Mario become a plumber? And how did he earn the enmity of a giant fire-breathing turtle?
Exactly. You would need to do that, I would think.
You think they created elaborate biographies for this little Italian handlebar-mustached guy?
Yes.
That's your choice, huh?
Yeah.
All right. No, it was drinking heavily.
No!
Have you ever seen this movie? You practically need to get slammed just to finish watching it, let alone acting in it. No, the movie, it was in fact the first major motion picture to be made from a video game, and it was an absolute disaster for everyone involved.
I'm sorry, Phil.
Well, hang on, don't be sorry yet. Carl, how did Mary Roach do in our quiz?
Mary needed at least two correct answers to win for Phil Sturt, but she had just one correct answer.
Be sorry now.
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It's Mary Roach is the author of a bunch of great, fascinating, and funny books, including Bonk and Stiff. Her latest is a great book called Packing for Mars. Go get it now. Mary Roach, thank you so much for being with us. Great to have you on the show. Just a minute, Carol pulls up in his limerick shaw and delivers the week's rhymes. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Right now, panel, some more questions for you from the week's news. Luke, according to investigators in Italy, a huge part of the new alternative energy economy there, windmills, recycling plants, that sort of thing, is controlled by whom?
The mafia.
Of course, yes. Good news. If the Italian mafia does not like you, they will no longer kill you and dump you in a landfill. Bad news, you'll be recycled and made into reusable shopping bags. Italian investigators seized millions of dollars of assets owned by these new green companies in Italy that they say are really controlled by the mafia, including his real name, Vito Lord of the Wind Nicastri. He's called that because of all the wind farms he owns. Other suspected green mafiosi in Italy include Vito the Garbage Sorter Spadaforte, Tony Tiny Carbon Footprint Marchese, and Johnny Low Flow Toilet Bondaro.
I feel like if like I was, you know, had a bag over my head, like I had gone, you know, sideways with the green mafia,
yeah,
and they like, you know, were like taking me off somewhere, and I knew they were probably going to do away with me. Then they opened the trunk, and I got out, and they took the bag off, and I realized they had driven me there in a Prius.
Yeah,
I would be like way less scared.
Right.
It's also very hard to find a vegan horse's head.
Luke, Apple is forcefully denying a report from Bloomberg News that CEO Steve Jobs was involved in an incident with airport security in Japan. What reportedly happened?
Oh, man. Did they want him to turn off his iPhone?
No.
They wanted to take off his black mock turtleneck to go through security.
No.
Can I give him a hint?
You may.
Who else might? Don't they also wear black mock turtlenecks?
They
the
do.
The guys
actually.
Who use these.
Mimes. There was a mime troupe that attacked him.
No.
Gang of jewel thieves.
He was picking up supplies for ninja school, is what Paul was getting at.
Oh, okay. He wanted to take a throwing star on
yes.
the plane?
They took away his ninja throwing stars, says Bloomberg News. They checked his luggage, and they said, well, you can't take these ninja stars onto the plane.
Doesn't he have an app for that?
And Steve Jobs is like...
He just, like, throws a ninja star at your email.
And Steve Jobs is like, it's my plane. It's unlikely that I'm going to try to hijack it. So I can tell it to go to Cuba, and it'll just go to Cuba. I own the plane.
Oh, it was his. He wasn't yeah. flying like.
So he got furious, and according to Bloomberg News, he was so furious at this that he says he'll never go back to Japan. Now, Apple issued a statement that said a complete fiction. He loves Japan. He's going to go back, but they didn't mention anything about the throwing stars. Yes or no? It was a hard thing. I mean, in the middle of it, he tried to call his lawyer, but he couldn't get through because all he had was an iPhone 4. And.
I was so obsessed with being a ninja as a kid.
Really?
I made a ninja star out of a found part from a washing machine.
Right.
And we waited our whole lives, me and my kids in my neighborhood that were in my ninja club, to have a rumble. But we were all the kids in the neighborhood were in the ninja club.
So who are you going to fight?
These other kids came to visit their granddad once, and I thought there was beef. I ran home to get my ninja star that was a gear from a washing machine. I ran back. I jumped up on the fence. But in fact, everyone had decided not to fight, but I didn't get the memo. So I threw a ninja star at this chubby kid and hit him in the stomach. And I was like, success. And everyone, even my friends, went, why did you do that?
Because I am ninja, you said.
Yeah. So I slunk back home, and that was the end of my ninja career.
Well, this is why you can't take washing machine parts on a plane anymore either. Yeah.
Paula, British farmer Roe Mears is appealing to the public to donate their unused brassieres to her at her farm. Ms. Mears is a fruit grower, says she doesn't intend the items for personal use. She says, therefore, what?
Packaging fruit.
Not quite. It's pretty obvious when you think about it. She's a fruit farmer. She grows large fruits that grow on vines.
So she wants to hold up the fruit, keep it on the vine longer.
She's supporting the...
Supporting the tomatoes.
No.
There's another thing they call that.
The grapefruits.
No.
The nuts, the grapes, the...
Melons?
The melons!
Yes! She wants the donated bras to support her melons.
I couldn't stand to see you suffer anymore.
Ms. Meir says her Galia melons were outgrowing their vines and were, quote, swinging too low. We needed something to lift and separate. Then I looked down and I realized the answer was under my nose. Mears added she's still trying to figure out the best way to transport fresh milk from the barn to her home. The tractor is no good because her jugs keep bouncing.
I don't know. You know, I have a silly picadillo, which is that I call body parts by their names. I know, it's crazy. And I've taught my kids to do it, and socially they are out. But you know, to me, a breast is a breast, and the idea that you would call it...
Well, on
it...
some women, it's a melon, baby.
Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank. But first, it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Or click the Contact Us link at our website, waitwait.npr.org. There you can find out about attending our weekly live shows here at the Chase Bank Auditorium in Chicago. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Excellent. Hi, I'm Prashant from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I go to college in Chicago.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's pretty excellent.
It is pretty excellent. Well, why are you calling us from Tulsa? Were you afraid of us?
Well, I figured that my parents probably needed to see me sometime this summer, unfortunately.
Oh, I see. So you wanted to go home and see them. Prashant, welcome to the show. Carl Castle is going to read you three news-related limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly, and two of the limericks will be a winner. Here is your first limerick.
Old memories hang round like a ghost, and smells seem to rouse them the most. My own little Proust is back home to roost when I smell some hot buttered
toast.
Right, toast. Feeling blue? Make some toast. That's the advice from Professor Tim Jacob of Cardiff University, who's determined that the smell of toast triggers feelings of happiness. Said Jacobs, quote, "It is clear that toast reminds us of family. Toast is used as a treat and to cheer us up, so toast is therefore comforting." Unquote. So true. I mean, who among us doesn't remember coming home after trick-or-treating with a pillowcase full of toast? Or being sick and having your mother bring you a piping hot bowl of toast.
We used to have toast when we were sick. Milk toast. Did you ever have that?
No, this is the toast you dip in milk? Is that how
it works? No, you cut it up in a bowl, put a little nutmeg on there, perhaps some butter, and then you pour milk over it, and it's milk toast. It's very yummy. So very healing, very comforting.
I'm glad you know that.
Yeah, I'm trying to help.
Thank you. Here is your next limerick.
For out-of-work schlubs, it's the hub. It's our club where we drink and eat grub. While seeking employ, why not have some joy? Let's have job training here in our
pub.
Right, pub. If you're out of work, you want to look for a job, and you want to get drunk. Now you can do both, at least in Berlin. The Kindle Klaus pub there offers patrons free advice on how to find work while they drink. It's a good idea, but it has created some awkward moments when patrons have woken up the next morning in terrible jobs they don't really want to do. It's a phenomenon known as job goggles. Oh, man, I don't even remember the name of the position. What am I going to do? All right, here is your last limerick.
This lady looks great. Oh, my gosh. I'm glad I am clean. I just washed. She speaks, I drift far. I stare at a car. My mind wanders to that fast
Porsche.
Right. In a phenomenon Dutch researchers call the Porsche effect, the sight of attractive women inspires men to buy expensive goods like Rolexes and Porsches. It's a long-held belief that women like men with expensive stuff. So the problem is, you see attractive women, you buy an expensive car, which causes more women to flock to you. So you see those women and you buy more expensive cars. And pretty soon you're surrounded by beautiful women and expensive cars, which isn't so much a problem as it is a hip-hop video. Carl, how did Prashant do in our quiz?
Well, Prashant, you had three correct answers, so congratulations. You
won our
prize.
Yes, my mom will be ecstatic.
There you are. Your mom will be ecstatic?
I'm playing for her.
Oh, you are? That's wonderful. You're a good son. Thank you so much for playing, Prashant. We'll see you back here in Chicago.
Thank you very much.
Now on to our final game, Lightning Fill-in-the-Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Paula Poundstone has the lead, Peter. She has 4 points. Luke Burbank has 3. Paul Provenza has 2.
All right. Paul, you are in third place, so you're up first. The clock will start when I begin your first question. Fill-in-the-blank. After a diplomatic deal, one of the hikers was released from captivity in blank.
Iran.
Right. After months of debate on Thursday, the Senate passed a $42 billion bill designed to help small blank.
Businesses.
Right. Questions about the safety of aging gas pipelines arose after last week's deadly explosion in blank.
In Northern California. San Bruno.
Right. The White House is disputing a report in a new book claiming that blank said she hates her job.
Michelle Obama.
Right. This year's London Fashion Week featured the first ever blank.
Meat fashion thing.
Aerosol spray-on clothes.
Nice.
Longtime NBC broadcaster and language critic blank died at age 91.
Edwin Newman.
Right. A University of Delaware graduate student beat Ken Jennings' record for highest one-day total on blank.
Guitar Hero.
No. Jeopardy. Okay. The Minnesota Appeals Court ruled the police did not violate a suspect's right to privacy when they found a gun on him while blanking.
Shooting a guy.
No. Why? They found a gun on him while they were helping him to pull up his pants. Police ordered the suspect to step out of his car and put his hands in his head, and when he obeyed, his pants fell down. And when an officer reached down to pull him up for him, she discovered a pistol in his pocket. The judge ruled the search valid and rejected the defendant's argument that he was just happy to see her. Carl, how did Paul do in our quiz?
Paul had 5 correct answers for 10 more points. He now has 12 points, and Paul has the lead.
Well done. All right, Luke, you're up next, fill in the blank. Inspiring none of the controversy of last year, President Obama made a speech Tuesday to the nation's blanks.
I have no idea.
School children.
Okay.
According to a census...
If that's what you say.
According to a Census Bureau report, the recession has caused the blank rate to jump to 14.3%.
Unemployment.
No, poverty rate. After receiving
two for two.
After receiving a bomb threat, police in France briefly shut down the blank.
The Louvre.
No, the Eiffel Tower.
I'm hot.
A new study from the Center for Disease Control found that there was no link between autism and blank.
Shots that they give people to not get sick.
Called?
Vaccines.
Yes. A Christian college in Michigan decided to cancel a scheduled concert by the band of the New Pornographers when they realized blank.
They weren't actually going to do pornography on stage.
No, they canceled it when they realized the band was called the New Pornographers. They thought it was inappropriate. Sean Duffy, a GOP congressional primary winner in Wisconsin, is best known for his prior role in MTV's reality show blank.
The Real World?
Right. Although he snubbed her show once before, Oprah picked the new book by blank for her book club.
Jonathan Franzen.
Right. Police in Florida put handcuffs on a suspicious blank that was found loitering near an elementary school.
Flamingo.
No, a 7-foot-long alligator. A crossing guard spotted the gator loitering near an elementary school Monday and called police, who handcuffed its back legs together. Now, handcuffs, while very effective on humans, don't necessarily work on species where the hands are really not the most threatening part of the body. Carl, how did Luke do on our quiz?
Really well.
Luke had 3 correct answers. For 6 more points, he now has 9 points, but Paul still has the lead with 12 points.
All right. And how many, then, does Paula need to win?
4 to tie, 5 to win outright.
All right, Paula, this is for the game, fill in the blank. Yeah. BP announced that they will have the leaking oil well in the blank permanently sealed by Sunday.
In the Gulf?
Yeah, Mexico. A meeting with the Queen marked the beginning of the first papal visit to blank in centuries.
England.
Right, Great Britain. On Monday, it was announced that 500,000 government workers will be laid off in blank.
Cuba.
Right. In a $12 million deal, Jennifer Lopez signed on as one of the judges on blank.
American Idol.
Right. As part of his campaign, a third-party candidate in Louisiana has challenged Senator David Vitter to a blank.
Duel.
Close, but it's a mixed martial arts cage fight.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, Reggie Bush announced that he is forfeiting his 2005 title as the winner of the blank.
Eating contest.
No, Heisman Trophy.
Yeah.
Billy Mae Richards, best known as the voice of red-nosed Christmas hero blank, died at age 88.
Oh, rough.
Yeah, red-nosed reindeer. A California bank manager was able to stall a bank robber by making him blank until cops arrived.
By making him go through the velvet ropey thingies.
No, by making him fill out loan paperwork. Mark Smith walked into the Watsonville Bank, said he had a bomb, and demanded $2,000. Bank manager said, $2,000. Well, sure, but we'll just need you to fill out loan form 2B, section 12. While Smith was working in the paperwork, the manager called the cops, who quickly helped him change his address entry to jail. Carl, did Paula do well enough to win?
She needed 5 correct answers to win, and she had 5
Hey, Paula Poundstone.
14 points.
Been a while.
Paula Poundstone is the champion.
I like it. Well done, Paula. In just a minute, we'll ask our panelists to predict what Oprah will do to top the free trip to Australia for her audience, what her next big surprise will be. But first, let me tell you the support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the National Association of Realtors, providing information for those buying or selling their homes at houselogic.com/buy and sell. Public Notice, an independent organization dedicated to reducing government spending. Learn more at thepublicnotice.org. And Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes prefinished and stained solid hardwoods, bamboo, cork, and laminates. Information at lumberliquidators.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Gotica writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our intern is Blythe Haga. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Lester Largic and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, how will Oprah top the trip to Australia? What's your next big thing? Luke Burbank.
Trap Chilean miners. Under your seats, you're all getting an extra ration of toilet paper.
Paul Prevenza.
The entire audience is going to Mars, where everyone will receive a copy of Operation Dark Heart.
Paula Poundstone.
We're going to Alabama.
And if Oprah does any of those things, panel, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to Luke Burbank, Paul Prevenza, and Paula Poundstone. Thanks to all of you for listening. You're great. We love you. See you next week from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
This is NPR.